Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm your host, Nikki Sweat. In 18th century Austria and Hungary, groups of cavalry would travel from town to town, recruiting young peasants into the military. In each town, they would perform a ferbunkos, a recruiting dance, to music that was usually played by traveling groups of Romani musicians. As more and more of the soldiers joined the dance, the music would grow faster and faster, twirling, spinning, dashing furiously, to impress the prospective recruits. Composers across Europe became familiar with the ferbunkos. They came to associate it not so much with the military, but with the virtuosic Romani violin music that led the officers in their dance. The techniques and structures of these dances became associated with a folk-influenced style of music that people like Joseph Haydn began incorporating into the music he wrote and published for performances in court and in homes of aristocratic amateur musicians. The most famous example of this process that Haydn produced is the final movement of a piano trio in G major that he wrote in London in 1795, a rondo labeled All'Ungherese, or After the Hungarian in Italian. But all of the pieces on this concert program, on the final main stage concert of the Menlo season, which will be given on August 6th, allude to a Romani style of violin playing in different ways. In the opening of Haydn's G major trio, there is little indication that the piece is heading toward a virtuosic, folk-inspired finale. The first movement is based on a sweet and inviting refrain, though as we might expect from Haydn, it does have an unpredictable number of measures. The movement is a short set of ornamental variations on this theme, but between the variations, there are minor key episodes that depart from the scheme of that theme. The first of these departures proceeds from a melancholy inflection of the initial tune. The second intervening episode is more of a stark contrast. The sextuplet arpeggios of the violin are disruptive and almost competitive. But even these dramatic intervening passages can't arrest the sweet disposition of the main tune, as the instruments chatter around it in various ways to the very end. The adagio movement, marked cantabile, is more expressively complex. The opening, a piano solo with simple figurative accompaniment by the strings, has a number of poignant harmonic diversions. The violin sings a lullaby in a central section. In this passage, Haydn gives the violinist a chance to sit briefly on a perfect fifth. For just a moment, we hear the raw, open quality of a folk instrument, the barest hint of the music that's to come. The final rondo movement opens with a tune that scampers around like something written by Mozart. The first contrasting episode suggests something a bit more rough and rustic. Then the Ferbunkos proper begins. Offbeats, sudden shifts in dynamics, and implied but usually performed jumps in tempo. The minor key section that follows has regular sforzandos, syncopations, and rapid alternations of bowed and pizzicato notes, markers that this is an imitation of a folk style of violin playing. Returns to the Mozartian ritornello are brief. Haydn prefers to keep us in the world of that Hungarian recruiting dance. It's the alternation of these characters that's probably the most striking feature of this movement. It's the kind of study in stylistic contrasts that Haydn was particularly good at, and an exposition to just one of the ways that composers have borrowed and reimagined folk and Romani approaches to compositional structure and instrumental technique. The Czech composer Erwin Schulhoff, born in Prague in 1894, spent much of his 20s in Germany, studying and working as a composer. He absorbed many influences during this time, the atonal and expressionist music of composers of the Second Viennese School, like his friend Alban Berg, certain more conceptual and ironic approaches to writing music, and also the jazz music that swept across Europe in the late teens and early 1920s. When he returned to Prague in 1923, he enhanced this mix by incorporating elements of Eastern European folk music into his compositions. I spoke with the cellist Mihai Merica about Schulhoff's 1925 duo for violin and cello. It's a piece that displays this composer's mix of folk elements with a more atonal sound world, where little units of melody are developed through imitative dialogue.
What strikes me in the first movement as a cellist is these enormous leaps that he makes that are kind of technically very challenging and reminiscent of the Second Viennese School in the way they use short words, if you want to call elements of a phrase words, in very extreme intervals. I can see quite a bit of that influence throughout the first movement. Also, folklore, the way he uses rhythms, especially short, like, bursts of rhythmic power. Very reminiscent of folklore, but that continues in the next movement as well. In preparing for this interview, I ended up looking up a bunch of stuff. And one of the things that came up was this old documentary movie from the 90s called Lacho Drom. I think Lacho Drom means good journey or good road. And it describes the path that the Roma musicians, or in the Roma people, took from the Punjab all the way to Spain. You hear the influence of Indian music on the Romani way of making music and the other way around. So as you move from country to country, it kind of becomes clear in a unique way, the way in which Roma music influences the styles of other countries and what they take from those specific countries. And in the Romanian part of it, there's one tune where there's quite a bit of percussion. In watching it, you realize that the percussion is actually coming from a cymbalom flipped upside down. It's not a different percussion instrument. That kind of, it's a long way of getting to, kind of reminded me of this second movement of the Schulhof, in that in mimicking this Roma style of music making, he also mimics the use of the musicians. For example, in this one, the cello starts with almost like playing two instruments at once. You're using the bow and you're plucking the strings with the left hand. He wanted something percussive, but instead of going through the process of, well, do I know a percussionist? Maybe I should call a manager. No, this is all you have. You have two people, you got to make it work with what you have. So you use the instruments in whatever way is necessary to bring out the colors that you want.
Movement of Schulhof's duo opens with a special texture where the violin and cello trade sung lines and simple plucked accompaniments. I asked Mihai what he thought the composer was trying to capture in this moment.
I think they're trying to evoke a distant past or a distant place. That's what it seems to me. But there's a clear difference, even though both instruments use the same kind of meditative melodic approach. The way the two instruments say their own part is very different, especially when the other instrument is using the pizzicato accompaniment. it's a very strong language of his own, but that he uses very naturally and very convincingly to my ear. In the last movement, he repeats the thematic material from the first movement, but the way the two lines of the violin and the cello add up now to my ear sound like they rhyme. This very interesting texture that he creates towards the end. Suddenly, the music starts sounding quite a bit like Bartok's language, actually, to my ear. Tighter intervals and very concise rhythmic patterns. And I wonder if that was his way of indicating that his inspiration came from folklore, putting a final stamp on it, that this music comes from different places.
The Romani violinist Janos Bihari was living in Budapest in 1801. While there, he founded a highly successful concert band featuring four violins and one cembalum. They went on tour around Hungary and eventually across Europe, making several well-received stops in Vienna. Ludwig van Beethoven heard Bihari perform on several occasions and used one of his tunes in the overture to King Stefan. A young Franz Liszt also heard him play, and would later recall the tones of his violin flowing on our enchanted ears like tears. Bihari would learn the local folk songs in towns and cities that he visited, and revise and reinterpret them in his group's performances. He also wrote new melodies, many of which were transcribed. He suffered a hand injury in the mid-1820s, lost his performance career and source of income, and he died in poverty and relative obscurity. But his tunes remained popular after his death in 1827. Liszt, in his 13th Hungarian Rhapsody for piano, used a bit of a particularly vivacious song of Bihari's. And later in the century, the virtuoso violinist Pablo de Sarasate, when writing his Zigeunerweisen, Romani-inspired airs and dances for violin and piano, decided to close his piece out with that same number. Sarasate likely wrote Zigeunerweisen on an extended trip to Budapest in 1877. While there, he attended many concerts, heard music played on the street, and he actually paid a visit to Franz Liszt. The music that we hear in the piece is a mix of Hungarian tunes, and most of them did not have the Romani origins that Sarasate had assumed. The sultry number that precedes the furious final Verbunkos was in fact written by Hungarian composer Elemer Szentirme, who, on seeing that Sarasate had taken his tune, wrote to him insisting that he be recognized in the printed sheet music. The extensive introductory section of the piece uses other borrowed folk tunes. Here, Sarasate, like Haydn and Schulhoff, uses that technique of mixing bow strokes and left-hand pizzicato. He also instructs the violinist to give an exaggerated impersonation of a rhythmically free and changeable style of playing that had by that time become an exoticizing stereotype of Romani music. Johannes Brahms was another composer who borrowed from Bihari. Several of his highly successful Hungarian dances were built on tunes by the late virtuoso, transmitted to Brahms through the Hungarian violinist Ada Rémini. Brahms came to quite closely integrate aspects of folk and Romani style into the concert works that he wrote throughout his life.
He published his Hungarian dances. From what I understand, he took these melodies from a Hungarian violinist who he met very early in his life, and his name was Ede Remenyi, and they toured together for quite a while. In the natural way of learning folk music, Brahms kind of learned these tunes by ear, and it's interesting to, he says himself that the Hungarian dances are not his creation. He merely nourished the music. I think those are the words that he uses. It's an interesting way of Brahms saying, I did not come up with this stuff, but here it is. And then it turned out to be quite a big success for him financially as well. He starts by copying it, and by the end of his life, he's integrated it into his own writing.
Brahms's first piano quartet in G minor, carefully written between 1857 and 1861, ends with a famous rondo alla Zingarese that will close out this concert. As you'll hear, that rondo has much in common with the other folk-inspired music on the concert program. But this was a provocative and innovative piece throughout all of its four movements. Mihai explained how Brahms pushes the structure of sonata form and the capacities of the piano quartet forward in this piece.
I think in Brahms's time, the sonata form in the circles that came to listen to his music, the expectation was, I'm going to hear the first theme. Hear the second theme. I'm gonna get it, but I'll get more of it when we repeat it, right? The repetition is what allows the listener to familiarize themselves with the musical material of the piece. Brahms does in the first movement of the G minor piano quartet is play a trick on us. There's a moment where it feels like thematic material from the very beginning is slowly seeping back in, and you would expect the repeat to happen. And indeed, the first theme comes back just like in the opening. but it's not an actual repeat. Actually, he starts jumping between material from earlier on in very different orders. So it, never a dull moment in this piece, you know, as a listener. And I understand that people who first heard the piece were kind of taken aback by this approach and thought it was hard to understand because of that reason. Because he sets up the expectation of sonata form, but then takes you for a wild ride. To me, it sounds like the beginning kind of evokes the mysterious forces of nature in the next movement. Whereas in the middle, we have this very almost gallant feeling.
In 1937, Arnold Schoenberg wrote a massive orchestral arrangement of this quartet on a commission from the conductor Otto Klemperer. It served to emphasize the scale and ambition of Brahms's original, qualities that are particularly audible in the third movement of the piece.
I imagine Schoenberg deciding to arrange this piece because of this movement. It suddenly becomes very orchestral. You know, you have instruments doubling the lines in the opening. All the string instruments playing in the same notes, different octaves, but the same notes. It gives you this sense of a string section rather than three distinct instruments. In the last movement, most of it sounds like folk music. You know, us as cellists, what we're doing there is basically drumming. Later, the rhapsodic passages that the strings play, that to me also sounds kind of like Roma rhapsody. Even though the same material appears later in a very scholastic approach where he makes it into a kind of the beginning of a fugal passage between the instruments. And then the end, of course, it's a barn burner, as they say. Yeah, I think the unifying thread for me in this kind of program is the beautiful way in which different musics can interact and how they communicate to each other and what influence they have on each other. And it's especially in the case of Brahms with folk and Roma music, it's a beautiful example of cultural communication in a way that goes beyond language.
Audio notes are written and produced by Nikki Sweat in consultation with David Finkel and Wu Han. Many thanks to Mihai Merica for speaking with me on this session. Musical excerpts appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. Haydn's Piano Trio in G Major, HOB 1525, was performed by Gil Shaham, David Finkel, and Wu Han. Schulhoff's Duo for Violin and Cello was played by Daniel Hope and Paul Watkins and can be heard on the album Forbidden Music on Nimbus. Sarasate's Sie Gunnerweisen, Opus 20, was here performed by Matthew Arama and Aurelien Pontier. It can be heard on the album Violin Showcase, released on the Brilliant Classics label. And Brahms's Piano Quartet No. 1, in G minor, Opus 25, was performed by Daniel Hope, Paul Neubauer, David Finkel, and Wu Han, and can be heard on the album Piano Quartets, Brahms, Schumann, Mahler, on Deutsche Grammophon. Audio notes are a copyrighted production of Music at Menlo.